What up, everyone? This is episode 5 of Hidden Apron Radio. My name is Paulo Espanola, and I just got back from the gym. Let me tell you guys, if there is anything you can do to up your productivity, feel better, feel like you could take on the world, nothing beats getting your sets in at the gym. Now, don't get me wrong, I am by no means cut. I am not swole for like the longest time. I have been this scrawny little kid. I still think I am. But I say this because nothing else makes me feel so much more productive and can take on the day like going to the gym. Which takes me to the point of where I was going with this adrenaline-fueled rant right now, and how intense I feel, I suppose. Takes me to the subject of today's podcast episode, intensity. Because nothing else can explain this episode quite like that word. I would equate it to kind of like taking a breakneck kayak run down a raging river full of twists and turns, fueled by an engine that runs on high octane caffeine and a liberal dose of righteous fury. That's the only way I could explain this episode. It's one of those episodes where we dive deep into a particular subject and there's a lot of ranting and we go off into multiple tangents, but I would say it is laid out in such a way that facilitated a lot of aha moments for me, and I think it will for you too. And the topic is something surprising, right? It's not something we would usually equate with the terms like intense and raging river full of twists and turns, but the topic is farming. And our helmswoman for this episode is Ayesha Verayu. So I met Ayesha at a Filipino-American conference here in New York a couple years back. She spoke about her transition from an investment banker specializing in leverage finance, debt syndication, a lot of these big financy terms that I have no clue what they mean. But she basically went to social entrepreneurship with her organization, the Advancement for Rural Kids, or ARC for short. So ARC seeks to feed kids and get them back to school. So obviously when I heard her talk about transitioning from run-of-the-mill corporate life to a food-related venture, my only thought was, I gotta be friends with her. Like, I wanted to be her when I grow up. If I ever will grow up. So basically chased her down, talked to her in the lobby of wherever the hotel that the conference is being held at. I followed up with her for emails. Fast forward several years to today, and Ayesha is one of my closest friends, hands down one of my most valuable mentors, and Hidden Apron's biggest supporter. Besides my mom, because, you know, mom was always number one. However, while ARC, the organization that she runs, has won a lot of awards for its revolutionary feeding program, where it only costs 5 cents to feed a child a fresh, local, and sustainable meal, many don't actually know that before she started ARC, and after the job at as an investment banker, Ayesha, who has a degree in biology and chemistry from Mount Holyoke, was actually a farmer. That's quite the career change, and one big reason why I really wanted to get her onto the show. She basically traded long hours behind a desk for even longer hours on a field, and today is part one of my two-part conversation with her. We basically talked for more than 2 hours, so I had to chop this episode into two. I will warn you, though, that I was definitely not exaggerating about this being a rapid run down a raging river. We cover a ton of stuff. There's a lot of interrelated parts. She even admits that this might challenge the more linear thinking of our listeners, and we get into the weeds a lot. Heck, one of my good friends, Rita, who was sitting silently in the corner while I was conducting this interview, actually jumped in midway, because it's just one of those topics where it was just hard to watch silently without being a participant. And we hope that you could feel the same when you're listening to Ayesha's insights. However, if farming isn't a topic you think, oh man, you know what? Farming? I know nothing about that. I really don't want to know anything about that. If you've wondered why certain things the way they are when it comes to food, for example, why farmers in developing nations are among the poorest, why organic farming is hard, or why organic food is priced at a premium, or perhaps what the connection is between your bowl of cornflakes and Peru, you have got to listen to this episode. Think of it like kind of like a Freakonomics style conversation that answers a lot of questions that you normally wouldn't connect to farming. We cover how she converted her entire farm in the Philippines into an organic one in a year, behavior modification when it comes to rewiring the way people think and eat their food, why bad food is so cheap, and, you know, all in all, this is one of the most insightful interviews we've had to date from a very multidisciplinary mind. So hopefully you like this first part. The second part will drop in a couple of days, and it does get a little bit emotional. I won't give away too much, but let's get on to the show. Here's Ayesha Verayu of Advancement for Rural Kids. Ayesha, welcome to Hidden Apron Radio.
Thank you. I am excited to be here.
I'm actually slightly... So full disclosure, we have been, or I have been drinking in your kitchen for like, what, 3 hours now?
At
we just
least.
Went through like a big four. Planning session. So if this is going to be typical of all the other times that Ayesha and I have hung out, it will ramble, potentially.
Potentially? It will ramble, absolutely.
just full disclosure, so, right?
It would challenge the people who think linearly.
That's such a polite way to put it. We're going to confuse the hell out of you.
I like to call it, like, you will travel around the world with Paolo and Ayesha.
Yeah, all right. We should just start a whole new podcast.
There you go.
Right? But let's start with this, because this is, for me, when I was trying to frame what you do and put you in a box, unfortunately.
Oh, I hate boxes.
I know. If when you get to a party and someone says, like, Ayesha, what do you do? How do you answer that?
What do I do?
Yeah. Well, like, you know... To most people, they're like, oh, I'm this at my day job. Like, how do you answer, what do you do?
I don't know. I do a lot of things. And that's, so it, but if you boil it down, I invest in people and I invest in enabling them to achieve their greatness.
Right. And your current initiative in doing that is ARC.
In ARC. And it starts with feeding.
Okay.
Feeding kids. Because you can't achieve greatness if you're not even stemming the bleeding. And if the bleeding is hunger, then you've got to solve that first. And once you stabilize that, then you can actually start dreaming. Then you can actually start like thinking about what you want to be. And
right.
That is what excites me, because I'm addicted to people, and I'm addicted to their dreams and them venturing into new things. And I get off of that. Like, I love seeing people challenging themselves and being excited and scared and but still gunning for it. Like, that shit is sexy. It's like, it fucking gives me goosebumps.
Right. So to give some context, because ARC is not just a feeding program though.
Correct.
Right? So real quick, if people were to ask you, what is ARC? Real quick, what is it?
We get kids back to school.
Okay.
And we create income with their rural communities so that they can transform their lives.
Right. And it's not a new program. So I know, I mean, being involved in ARC personally, that a lot has been accomplished in the years that's been in operation. So if you had to give a quick summary of what you guys are up to today, some key milestones, I guess, what has been your proudest achievement in the past year? What would it be?
People coalescing together and dreaming things that they never thought they could do before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for every community that we have worked with and partnered with. Like, that what continues to get me just so jazzed up and getting up in the morning is, it's not just the fact that the kids are finally going back to school.
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking fantastic. You know, like, it's also the fact that kids all of a sudden now are like, you know, they're coming up with ideas. Like, their eyes are like glistening. They're, you know, in a good way, you know, not in a hunger type of way. And they're, oh God, I think it's awesome when teachers start doing Excel, things that they never thought they would ever be able to do before.
Yeah.
And actually like using Excel, tracking their impact and getting promoted and getting recognition and seeing rural communities who, you know, before that, was stuck. You know, they didn't have people who believed in themselves, right?
Right.
And now they're actually seeing their own solutions being implemented by themselves. And because they are implementing these solutions by themselves, they're actually doing it. They're inspiring other people like ARC, like, you know, other partners that we've brought on to invest alongside them. So that, like in the past, you know, the first feeding program that we piloted was in 2009. I can't do math, but that's probably what, 6 years now, right?
Yeah.
We've since replicated the feeding program, which costs us only 5 cents, right, in 7 communities. We were, unfortunately, you know, we had in 2013 and 2014, there was a terrible situation that happened in our partner communities. Haiyan devastated all of them, and we had to put pause on our scaling dreams of sharing the feeding program to like other places in the Philippines and other places in the world where they want their kids to go to school, they want to secure their own food, you know. And these are like, it's unthinkable that farmers can't feed their own kids. Like that did, like that shouldn't happen.
Right.
Right. And so we want to scale that. We want to share that and enable other communities to do it. And then unfortunately in 2013, 2014, we had to, you know, focus on our partner communities first and focus on making sure that they bounced back, that they recovered from Haiyan, and that we were getting kids back to school and creating much needed income, especially after that devastation.
Right. So this actually surprised me because when I looked at the name, right, Advancing for Rural Kids, one of the questions I wondered before was, why is the word Filipino missing in there? You know, I always thought, well, also partly ignorance, but you mentioned it now that you want to scale this to other parts of the world. Was that always the vision? Is that why it was intentionally Advancement for Rural Kids? Because you'd think of like other, I'm supposing other charities would be like, yes, we're in the Philippines, that's our focus. Was it always from the outset something that was going to be scalable on a global scale?
Yes. And the reason for that is because farmers in the Philippines experience the same kind of poverty, the same kind of shit that farmers in Colombia, in Guatemala, in like Tanzania, in Vietnam experience, mm-hmm. you know, and what they're experiencing right now is particularly in, you know, like the farmers in the Philippines and farmers who have been farming with, as an example, chemical farming, right. Been using chemicals to farm, is it's created a market and a system that almost prevents them from succeeding, right? You have chemicals create a farming situation that's very linear. And what I mean by that is you have to buy the inputs all the time.
By the way, what do you mean by inputs?
Your seeds, your fertilizers, your herbicides, your pesticides.
Right.
Right. That's chemical farming. And prior to the advent of chemical farming, you had farming that was very cyclical, very ecological. It was a closed system, right? Mm-hmm. And the difference between, so now I'm going to bring back my grandparents or go back to my grandparents' time when they farmed. And when they farmed in a very ecological and organic way where it was a closed system. And what I mean by that is every output is an input into something else, mm-hmm. right? So they made their own compost. Their paddies had rice, had fish, had vegetables in it. So when they harvested the rice, they were not just harvesting rice once a year to feed them their entire family and to sell the excess to the market, but they were also, you know, harvesting fish that not just again feeds their own family, but this is protein that the rest of the villagers also, you know, buy and right. benefit from, right?
It's also
and
then on top source. Of that,
and it's also an income source. Right. And then there's vegetables. So you had this like ecosystem that was completely, that was one fed itself, right? From an ecological standpoint, right? The fish shat in the paddy. Mm-hmm. The manure provided nutrients in the soil, right? Certain paddies had ducks, right? And so that also like added additional like protein and also like additional like nutrients and nitrogen in the soil. You needed the nutrients and the nitrogen in the soil to grow the rice. Rice being the staple for everyone that gives us the carbohydrates to do work. And, you know, farming work requires a lot of carbs because it's manual labor.
Right.
So And then there's vegetables because you also need like the vitamins, right? So it literally provided like a plate from a nutrition standpoint complete. Mm-hmm. And that also made the family also complete, right? And now, so that was when my grandparents farmed. During my grandparents' time, the only big problem that you had in poverty or in farming communities was, I'm now going to go into the second problem, right? Yeah. In the developing world.
Yeah.
Particularly countries that have been colonized, yeah. Which is the feudal system, right? So before, if you were a farmer, you never went hungry, which is no longer the case. Now you're a farmer and you're going to be hungry.
That's strange because, you know, like growing up, my image of a farmer, obviously it's wrong, but I was like, oh, like farmers, they're always the poorest. And that's not always been the case.
No, absolutely not.
Or at least right? It shouldn't be. Right. I mean, they're growing food.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they may not have a Lamborghini, but, you know, when you think, define poverty, right? Like poverty and wealth, those two words are like, I call it relative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can have wealth and poverty with respect to happiness, with respect to health,
right.
With respect to money.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now, right, so farmers before, I should say, let's go back to farmers before, had health, right?
Mm-hmm.
Had happiness, right? They didn't have broken homes where one of their daughters is in, you know, in the Middle East working to support the rest
of
their family.
By broken, you mean like separate, like people are in different
correct.
Places, right?
Correct. Okay. Because like if you think about rural communities, right, and if you think about the Philippines, in any agrarian society or system, it really starts from the family as a unit,
mm-hmm.
right? And taking the Philippines as an example, like we pride ourselves in being like very family oriented, and we are. Like that family connection is so tight, mm-hmm. right? And so to actually break that unit, that's deep, that's painful,
mm-hmm.
right? And what caused that break? What caused that break is that deepened poverty, right? So, and what deepened that poverty was, it's not just a matter of the fact that, you know, they didn't have money to buy a car. It became, the deepening of the poverty was they didn't have the money to put food on the table, and they didn't have the money to send one of their kids to the hospital or the father to the hospital that's now been sick because of all the chemicals that's been put on the soil.
Right.
By the way, if you look at farmers, most of them, and I was speaking to like medical, you know, people in the medical field and people had done medical missions. When I ask them, like, okay, what are the diseases that you're seeing a lot in rural areas? And the number one thing to talk about is respiratory. And of course, why? I mean, you're spraying pesticides and you're spraying, God, pesticides is basically diluted form of Agent Orange, okay? Let's not fucking, like, you know, dumb it down, right?
Yeah.
I mean, or like sugarcoat it. If Vietnam has two generations or at least one generation of population disfigured and deformed because of Agent Orange,
mm-hmm.
right? And now in farming, chemical farming, now we're using, you know, a diluted version of this, right? And not expect that farmers in their 50s are going to get cancer, whether it's in the throat, in the stomach, or in their backs, you know,
yeah.
And not expect that people will have coughing and, you know, all these other respiratory issues. We're being naive.
Right.
So the poverty is deepened because of one, and I'm sorry, I'm going to make an attempt to make this clear. When you go for chemical farming, right, the number one thing that happens is you have to buy all of your inputs. And all of those inputs are made by companies outside of the U.S. Some are made in the not outside the U.S., made in the U.S., outside of the Philippines. Some may be made in the Philippines, but it doesn't matter. All these inputs are oil byproducts. So if the price of oil goes up, which we have seen in the past 10 years, and
right.
actually in 2006, 2007, like it went above, what, $125, $150 per barrel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a Filipino farmer, you're an Indian farmer, you're a Vietnamese farmer, right? All of a sudden, your market is your local currency, is your peso, but all of your inputs are based on dollar. How the fuck do you make money? That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, the Philippines and other places in Southeast Asia, even in India, that are like subject to, if you're in farming, and farming being like one of the hardest businesses, right? Because you're subject to like weather that you cannot control, right? You're a farmer, fucking typhoon comes, wipes out what you just put in the land, which what happened with Haiyan.
Right.
So now you're out of money because A, you borrowed that money to put into the ground for the seeds. You just bought all these chemicals. Again, you probably borrowed it, right? Because for rice and corn farming, it takes 3 months for you to like get your harvest out, right? So you're already out that money. Typhoon blows, takes everything that you've invested in the land. Now you have to struggle to figure out, A, how do you pay the people you borrowed money from? And then now you have to borrow additional money because now you have to put another thing on the ground because that's all you know.
Yeah.
Right?
It seems like a lot of dependencies that people don't normally think when it comes to farming, right? Yeah. Like the regular person, and even me, I admit this, even like, and I try to know what goes into my food. I would think, like, all right, farmers buy fertilizer and they plant the crops and they harvest it and we're done. You know, I wouldn't even think of oil prices.
Yeah. Well, think about it.
No.
That's the thing. Like, they don't.
Dependencies.
Right. And so farmers, actually, I was talking to Mambi Bing, who's our local coordinator for ARC, and she's also a farmer. She's actually my neighbor farmer. And one of the things, you know, we have gone organic since 2007 in my farm in the Philippines. And she's my neighbor. Her farm is right next to mine.
Right.
And I was telling her about, I feel like Monsanto now is going to put me on their list of their hit list. But that's okay. It's worth living. when I was sharing with her the book that a French journalist wrote about how Monsanto sees the world,
this
the
is world according world to Monsanto. Right. Who wrote that again, by the way? It's like Mary Monique.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Okay.
Ruben.
If I miss it, I will put it in the show notes for those who are listening who
want to check out the book. Yes, it is a must read. And so I was telling Mom Bibing about this book and also like all of the side effects of the chemicals. And you know what she said? She was like, we don't know this. The government should be protecting us from this. They just tell us that this is what you use, but no one tells us that these are all the different side effects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all farmers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about, as an example, Roundup, which is a pesticide that Monsanto sells. I remember, like, I'm reading in the book, of course, in France, apparently when they were doing the marketing for that pesticide, they literally showed a kid in the advertisement, in the TV advertisement and in the print advertisement, literally like a kid and a dog, you know, next to like the pesticide or like someone spraying the pesticide in the garden. So that makes you think as a consumer that, like, it's safe. But it's not, right? No one knows. So if you're a consumer and you're in a farmer, and again, going back to the developing world and going back to really right now, if you think about our food, if you think about that banana that you've had this morning, right? If you think about that cornflake that you had, by the way, that cornflake came from Peru because Kellogg sources 70 or 75% of their corn from, you know, corn.
They're not to from put the cornfields of Iowa?
No.
Yeah, sure. From like, Peru. This is becoming a very, like, I've already had my mind blown like 3 times. Like, this is nuts.
Why?
I did not know that. There's like, you know, this is, all right,
Kellogg sources a lot of their corn from Peru.
Okay.
But if you think about everything that you eat from breakfast to dinner, most of that food is sourced from the developing world. Mm-hmm. And so when people ask me, why do I do ARC? And I live in New York City and I should care about causes in New York City and in the US, and I do care, right? It's hard for me to, it's because of this, right? It's because I do care about what we eat here, right? And I would rather eat something high quality mm-hmm. and something healthy. And by the way, when I demand that as a consumer, I'm also benefiting on the other end, right? Farmers.
Right. You basically trace the line and see that directly affects what you eat here in New York.
Absolutely.
Right? I wanted to go back because I know, so, you know, most people who see this, they see ARC, right? At least people who know you in New York, they see ARC. And when I've read through I was mentioning a while ago, there's all this stuff written about you online. But the one thing that is always, they only save like one sentence for, and they never really go into, is the fact that you actually became a farmer.
Yeah.
So, and that kind of explains how you know all this stuff. And I wanted to get into that part a bit. Because you were an investment banker for how long again?
Close like 12 years.
12 years, right? Close, and then 07 years. Is when your farm went fully organic. Your mom's farm back in Philippines.
Yes.
I would assume that when you became a farmer from iBanking, you didn't know all this stuff yet. Or did you already?
Actually, I don't.
Because converting a farm to organic, I would assume, is not just something that's like everyone knows, right? Like you had to somehow get this information somehow.
I was actually trying to remember how I got into reading about farming books. And the only thing I remember was, so in 2006, at the height of M&A activity, and I was an acquisition finance and leverage finance banker at that time. So I was super busy, to say the least. Like, I remember, I still remember being in an office, being in my office early morning, and my mom, and I had to take a call from my mom because I had a live transaction, and my mom was saying, hey, your cousins are selling out their stakes in the farm. So our family farm, we have, so this is the farm that my grandparents bought and developed, but it's small, but you know, it meant a lot for my mom, right? It's kind of like a legacy from her and from her parents. And so she didn't want it to go outside of the family. So she said, I want to keep it in the family. Do you want to buy the stakes from your cousin so that way we can keep in the family? And at that time, I was, you know, like I credit a lot of what I've learned and what makes, like what has made me to, I think, a good business person through my experience in banking. But at that moment, there was two things that I wanted to learn that I wasn't getting in banking. And that was, I wanted to operate and I wanted to invest. And so, I cannot say no to my mother. I don't know of any Filipino kid who can say no to their mother. And I'm probably one, you know, I'm part of that generation. And I said yes to it with two provisos. I said to her, I will invest provided that we make the farm organic and bring it back to the way my grandparents farmed it, you know, organic and ecological.
Well, I mean, you're here in the middle of M&A activity. Like, what made you think in a busy office, we got to go organic? Like I'm still trying to find out why, what was the...
To be honest, I don't know. I think it's because I love food. And maybe I started reading about it, about the benefits of organic food.
Mm-hmm.
Because of food. That's the part that I was saying. Like, I don't remember what got me thinking about organic.
Okay.
I don't remember it. But at that point, clearly I've been...
There was something strong enough that you said...
Yeah, it was in my kind of realm of awareness already.
Right.
Right.
So you knew you wanted to go organic. But the surprising thing for me is you somehow made that happen in a year.
It actually took a year and a half,
which is still pretty quick.
Well, it's because we can talk about that.
I do want to get into that because I think it's something that, like, when people think, you know, even my family, right?
Yeah.
And we don't have an organic farm, but when I bring up the subject of organic farming back there, it people's eyes kind of glaze over and it's like, oh, we don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm trying to get at. It's so, like, when you may have, you were an iBanker who may not have known the ins and outs of farming. How did you go about educating yourself?
Was it like, I read everything about organic farming. I read about permaculture. I went to a bank. Oh yeah. I was a banker by day and a farmer by night. I found myself reading, I still remember, like, in the middle of a live deal, like, I still remember on my sacred day, which is a Saturday, reading a book until 6 a.m. in the morning, and it was about organic farming, and I still have that book in my bookshelf.
What book is that, by the way?
I know how it looks, but I don't know the exact name. I will show you later. And I remember not feeling tired. I remember feeling just, I couldn't stop flipping the page. I could just kept consuming what I was reading. And that led me to just going deep in the industry, deep in the, in like just you know, like a sponge, just like sucking up all this information. Mm-hmm. And also, like, you know, attending, for example, like conferences that Salatin, for example, Joel Salatin does on his farm.
Yeah.
And, you know, and learning from people like him who, you know, have really, again, who are leaders in revitalizing ecological farming and bringing back there's no other word for it, the right way to farm, which is to farm with the environment.
Was it easy? Did you find that easier? I mean, like...
What, farming with the environment?
Was farming the right way, or the way it's been done before, versus, hey, let's just spray a bunch of pesticides and it'll take care of everything, and let's get higher yield crops. What was the biggest challenge of converting it to a closed circle organic farm?
To be honest, it's people.
Really? It's not the actual farming, the mechanics of it?
No, because for the mechanics, you can plan it, you can strategize, you have to give time for the soil to heal.
Right.
You have to understand what are the different, you know, elements that you need to put in the soil to accelerate the healing. And then you need to understand, like, what the plant needs, how to nourish it. But as soon as you understand those things, you can plan that, right?
So, yeah.
But the hardest thing to plan and the hardest thing to do is change behavior. And so when we first, you know, when I invested in the farm, in addition to making it organic, my other caveat was to change the labor practice, right?
What was it before?
So because none of my, you know, my parents, my grandparents, their kids ended up all going to the city to work, right? Mm. You have to understand that after World War II, it was pretty tough for my grandparents to like rebuild and support all 9 kids through farming alone. Especially after World War II. So like the first half of the kids, like the first 5 kids had a really, really comfortable life living in the farm. But my mother is part of like, my mom was number 8 of 9, really felt the difficulty post-World War II. So so since none of the kids were that interested in farming, my grandparents leased or rented the land to 10 other farming families. So each of these farming families took like a hectare and a half each.
How big is that?
A hectare and a half is about 3 acres.
Which is about what? I mean, like imagine a person who grew up in the East Village has no idea what an acre is. That's like, what, 3 blocks by 3 blocks? Like, I'm trying to figure
out. It would be like a block. It would be like half an acre. So 2 acres is probably in the Lower East Side or in East Village, just like 1 block. So two acres would be the full block.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
All right.
So they, and this is in the, you know, so now this is in the 1970s when their kids were all going to like the cities to work. You know, Philippines was a colony of the U.S. And the Philippines was essentially another extension market for any U.S. product. Right. So in the 70s, when quote unquote the Green Revolution, misnamed by the way, the Green Revolution happened here, right?
In the States.
In the US.
Yeah.
The Philippines became like, you know, a dumping ground for additional industrial chemical products. And just to give you contrast or comparison. In the Philippines, when I got into farming in 2006, 2007, most of the farmers I met going from Nueva Ecija all the way down to like, you know, Davao, they were all chemical farmers. It was very hard to find an organic farmer. In Panay and in the province of Capiz, which is where my family's farm is in, when we started 100% organic in 2008, and then in 2009, I was actually there to start changing like our marketing strategy.
Right.
The Department of Agriculture was laughing at us, right?
Why is that?
One, they thought that it wouldn't grow. They were like, oh, your yield is going to go down, right? And yes, your yield goes down. For us, it did for 2 reasons. One, the way we've made mistakes, right? The way we tried to convert from chemical to organic was too fast. You know, like what I mean by that is my mother kind of did, my mother who manages the operations in the farm, literally like kind of took the Band-Aid approach. And she had to.
Like just ripped it off.
Just ripped it off. She had to, because I remember looking at financials in 2006 and comparing it to 2007. 2006, we were both paying for both chemical fertilizers and organic fertilizers. In 07, like when the price of chemical fertilizers was so, so expensive, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense. And I'll talk about why in a second, because your market price for rice has been the same. It doesn't, you know, over the years, since 2006 until now, right? So if your input cost is increasing, but your sales price has remained the same.
You're basically, your margin goes down.
Not only do your margins go down, you don't even make money.
Yeah.
And you're deeper, you're not only are you in the red, you're in debt because you borrowed that money to plant that rice.
Right, right.
Right? So if, so my mother was looking at the numbers, my mother was like, fuck it. I'm just going to pull this like a Band-Aid. I'm just going to do 100% organic. Now, having learned that lesson, I would advise other chemical farmers who want to go into organic farming slightly different. And I would advise them to do it where, start from the top of, you know, look at your terrain, do organic for on the, you know, split up your farm, do organic on the parts of your farm that are in higher terrain that's not going to be affected by water, because water is very important. That's the second thing that, aside from people's behavior, that is very hard to manage. The second thing to that you have to actively manage is water. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so going back to why they were laughing at us, they were like, oh, your yield is going to be down, right? Because for farmers, they only think about harvest or yield. Somehow, because this generation of farmers, unfortunately, on average now, this generation of farmers in their 30s and 40s, the average, most of them left school in elementary school, right? So that already creates like a literacy issue and an information issue, right? So at some point they have forgotten to do, okay, yes, you must be interested in the harvest, but you must also put that alongside your cost. No one has done the math to show, yeah, your harvest is this, but if you incorporate all the costs, what's your profit? What's your ganancia?
Yeah, yeah.
They think ganancia is harvest. I'm like, no, that is not ganancia. Ganancia is when you put in all of your costs.
Which, by the way, ganancia means profit.
Profit, right. Yeah. That's borrowed from the Spanish. And the reason why they don't do it is because if you think about farming, again, if you think about how the numbers come in and how the cash flows come in, right? Your investment into that farm is coming in 3 months before you're harvesting, right? So they may have done the budget, but then when they harvested, they forgot to put it together, right? Because whatever that is, whatever money that they have gotten from the harvest, and by the way, right now, farmers on average only net, and I do this math with the farmers, with my neighbors, they net, chemical farmers right now in the Philippines net, if they're lucky, $500 for 3 months for 1 hectare of rice. $500.
Jeez. Wow, that's...
That's it. That's all they net.
This is quite shocking.
Right? And by the way, the average size of a family, farming family, is 5 to 7. So...
I mean, if you had to boil this down, right? Because it sounds like a lot of... There's a lot of different issues. One is the nutritional part of growing with a lot of chemicals. The other part, you said the biggest problem for you when you were converting to organic was changing people's behavior. It seems like there's just a lot of them.
Well,
what would you say is a root cause? Would it be people's behavior? Is it just misinformation and not having the right level of education?
Well, the root cause is it's really hunger, education, and the lack of a market. Right. And so the hunger and the education is strongly tied, right? Because if you, chemical farming has, it's another type of colonization. It's a corporate colonization. Because what it does is it, this generation of farmers, and this is the other reason why farmers at that time in 2008 were making fun of us, and in 2009 were making fun of us, is because they have forgotten how to apply what their parents did in terms of farming, right?
Or were taught that it was old, it's too old, and it's not.
Yeah, it's
like, not modern anymore.
Right. Well, yeah. it's It's there's practice and then there's just knowledge, mm-hmm. right? So, and like, I think what you're pointing out, and I'm going to make another attempt in simplifying this because it's actually quite simple. You have farmers right now that are farming chemically, and they farm chemically because that's the only way they know how to farm, right? And although, like, there are examples like us who are organic farmers, to be honest, it wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 years ago that the DA started touting organic farming
in the Department of Agriculture. Okay.
And actually now we're kind of like their poster child because we were like one of the first ones in Capiz who started farming organically. And I shit you not, when we started farming organically, farmers around us, first of all, they were doubtful. They were like, what? Your rice will grow without chemical pesticides?
Yeah.
Like, they were surprised. It's like, well, if you're not using the synthetic fertilizers, how can it grow? And that was so sad because it meant that they don't know how their parents farmed, which was farmed with just compost. Yeah. Because here's the problem with, and going back to the linearity, if you have a closed system, right? If you as a farmer made your own compost that was made out of, you know, all of like, the excess vegetation that you don't use, made from like the cacahuate leaves, that the cacahuate meaning the madre de cacao leaves, which is high in nitrogen, right? So within your own home, if you could produce the input for you to create an output being rice, right? And then you take that output, right? So the husk of the rice becomes another composting material, right? You actually are not dependent on anyone and on anyone except your consumers to buy your rice.
Right. Yeah. Right? You're decreasing your dependency on an external source.
And from a money standpoint, right? So clearly if you're poor, you're really tight with funds and you're really focused on the money. And I'm an ex-banker, so I am really focused on money and profit. So when I look at the Excel spreadsheet and when I look at the analysis, my cost went from, I remember paying like input cost of 200,000 pesos, 150,000 pesos for like, you know, like 10, I don't know, 8 hectares or 10 hectares, bringing it that down to like now, like I produce all of my compost and I value my compost, right? Assuming if I didn't produce that internally and I had to buy it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's costing me 16,000 pesos.
That's over half.
Over. I literally like brought it down by like a 10.
So this really becomes the issue is not so much, you know, whether it's hard logistically, but it really becomes an issue of education.
It's an issue of education.
Right.
And it's an issue of behavior and practice, right? Because so again, if you're a farmer and no one is coming in with a market that says, hey, I will buy your products provided that they're organic. Why would they plant organic?
That's the same issue that we had because when I asked my aunts, who were actually growing both, right? They were growing both like conventional and organic. And I said like, well, what are you pricing your organic? And they said, I can't sell it more than my conventional because no one's asking for organic. Everyone's like, well, it's rice. Rice is rice. You know what I mean? And they don't see the, like
that's,
what you said.
Yeah, I think that's just an issue. That's probably like a minor issue of like, not minor, it's a big issue, but it's not like the prime, like if you're going to cut it, right, it goes to the market thing. It's understanding your market. So to go organic, we had to change who we sold our rice to, right? Mm-hmm. So when I went there in 2009 for 3 months, there is no point selling my rice to a trader. So just to give you guys a sense.
Hold on real quick. I'm going to pause right here because we're a little over half. I'm just going to test the sound again and we'll continue. So we're taking a quick drink break, and this whole time, my good friend Rita, who actually, where did you, so you didn't know this, Ayesha, but she actually went to, where did you go for that mission?
The Haiti border of the Dominican Republic.
What were you doing there?
I was at a nutrition clinic for a month.
Isn't that crazy?
It's
nutrition
crazy.
Clinic.
Yeah, we were feeding malnutrition kids, and then afterwards, I helped start the We'll Work for Food organization at the University of Michigan.
What Ayesha was saying, what was the most surprising thing? Because you must have seen the same issues with when it comes to hunger. What of Ayesha, what she was saying struck you as like, oh my God, I didn't know that.
I think the conventional farming question in the Philippines is that is a perception issue. I think that there is an idea that you get more, like, again, she's right. It's a short, nothing really surprised me. I think the concept that's hard for people to grasp is that yields are immediately higher when you do conventional farming. And families in the Philippines don't have 6 months to transition. They have a month. And again, I really want to underscore the point that debt is such a huge issue in a farmer's life. You're in debt keeping your farm alive. That doesn't include the cost of sending your kids to school. And even if they're in public school, you know, there's a cost of losing labor, so you have to hire labor. It's this idea that as a farmer, you're in this constant fear of yield. So that's the main barrier, I think, to move from conventional to organic farming. And it's not because organic farming doesn't have the yield. It's because they have to sit there and take the time to be educated. They have to sit there and sacrifice money and take this risk that none of their other farmer neighbors are doing to adopt an ideology that they haven't seen the payoff of. So they're in debt, they're scared, they're worried, and then you ask them to do something which in the, not even in the long term, like years, but in a longer term than they're used to thinking, which is, you know, in the span of a month or 3 months, because palay takes like 12, like, I mean, from seed to palay, it's like 12 weeks, right?
Palay being what?
Unhusk rice.
Unhusk rice, okay.
And that's really when you start like counting yield, right? Is when you get to like
when you harvest. That's when you harvest, right. Is when you start counting yield. But yeah. So I agree with Rita, and that's why I say like behavior is the biggest problem to conversion, because one, they're in debt, and therefore they have
There's kind of that sense of fear.
It's almost like, you know, you have to pay back that debt, and so you're looking for certainty, right? Mm. And security, because you have to pay back that debt. It's like the gun in your head type situation. And then the second is that willingness, that desire, forget willingness, that desire to want to learn something new because it was something that they didn't have before. So I'm going to present two things. And I agree with Rita on the behavior, because when we went organic, and again, we, as I said earlier, like the farm was being leased or rented to 10 farming families. When I presented to them the opportunity to, one, join us in this farming corporation that I was creating that with my mom, to make one, to basically wipe out their debt, to buy back their leases, and to make them be part of a corporation where they get daily income for the work that they do.
Right.
And on top of that, percentage sharing on top line harvest, and on top of that, scholarships for their kids, and on top of that, continuing education for the farmers, so that if farming wasn't really for them and they were forced into it because that's all their parents knew and that's all they knew, if they get other skills, they can actually gun for what they want to do.
Basically, this is a good deal.
In my mind, it was a good deal. So my question to you is, of the 10 farming families, how many do you think picked me up on my offer?
Five.
Three. And the number one reason for that,
okay,
is fear of change. It was something new. They didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And the second reason is because of, it goes back to fear. It's really insecurity, right?
Yeah.
So farmers, particularly those who unfortunately did not have more education, right?
Right.
Had this insecurity because, again, all of the necessary, all the good information, unfortunately, are either written in English or in Tagalog, right?
Yeah.
So now you're required to read or know that language. And if you got out of school at the age of 10, third grade, you may not even know how to read in English. You may know how to read, but it may be in Ilonggo.
Yeah.
It may be maybe Tagalog, maybe, right? But if all the good information is in English, now you're intimidated. Now you don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you're coming already with that kind of insecurity, right? And so for most of the farmers, the basis is, and Rita touched on this, is they look at the conversion if they see someone else doing well, right?
So they need some. They need proof to see someone. Yeah.
Because they can't read.
Yeah.
The information in English, mm-hmm, right? Not that they can't read it. They can't read and process it and analyze it because they didn't have the skills to do that.
Right.
their only basis for conversion is yield, is seeing how high is the harvest.
The stock. Yeah.
And to see, like, you know, numbers. Well, I don't share my financials with anyone. It's a private company. I just know that I am better off with organic farming. Actually, I've shared my financials with my neighbors to inspire them to convert, right?
So you can actually, so what you're saying is you can actually make more money, not just because organic sounds better marketing-wise, but you could actually get better.
I'm telling you right now, I'm making more money with organic than with conventional.
Is this something?
And despite lower yield. And here's the reason. Your yield may come down, but your cost is so much less.
Right.
So I actually make profit. I just need to make sure that I've captured the right market.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Is it a misconception? Because, so, you know, with my limited knowledge of organic, so it's not true when people say organic, they're just like, dude, my costs are so high because I can't, you know, I got to put so much more labor into it. So I have to sell it at so much higher. Is that a misconception?
Yes and no. There is, when you're in the beginning of organic, well, here's the thing. I wanna retool your thinking of price point. Conventional farming and the price point for which you pay for conventional farming benefits from two things that organic farming does not have access to. Mm-hmm. Number one, subsidies.
Ah.
Number two, corruption.
And we're not just talking about PNAS. Right.
No,
because subsidies also happen here.
Exactly. Think about the corn subsidies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, because farming is a business of scale.
Right.
Right? So, let's say, so that's one part. It's the subsidies and in the Philippines, the corruption of, like, kind of, you know, the preferential treatment that chemicals get. Right?
Yeah.
So, if you build in, right? If you take away the subsidies, and if you build in the harm that comes through chemical farming,
you're actually losing.
The cost of your food should actually be more than if you bought it organic.
Yeah.
Because what people forget to add is the health cost, right? So think about organic farming. The farmers, my neighbors don't think about this or don't put it together, is their visits to the doctor because of their health, right? The medicines that they buy because they're coughing, right? The medicines that they buy because of their stomach ache. Why? Because all that chemicals that goes into our grain, guess what? Creates so much gas in your stomach. It creates so much, like, think you ingest that, right? And our body, right? All of those toxins in our body is accumulative, right? So when you think of cancer, right? It's highly tied to chemicals in the soil.
Right.
So when you start adding in all of the medical costs that you pay for, the cost of eating conventional is actually more than the cost of eating organic.
Right. So the only reason conventional is cheaper in the market is because, one, subsidies.
One is subsidies, yeah. And second
at
is...
At least the biggest part is eating subsidies.
Yeah. The biggest part is subsidies. And also the other thing, right, is if you think of conventional farming, most of the farms now, so like, I want to go back a little bit to the yield, for example. So when chemical farming first came out, right, they were like, oh, this is fantastic. Look, we're getting all this yield. And by the way, now I don't need to hire the labor because I could just spray it and I don't need people to, like, you know, weed.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So in the first 5 years, it was fine because the soil was healthy, right? And the harvest was high. Guess what? All of my neighbors who are chemical farmers, we now have similar yields because after 30 years of farming, you've now depleted the soil.
Yeah.
And actually all the chemicals feed into that plant because there's nothing in that soil. I'm the only farm in my neighborhood, in the village, that have frogs. Can you imagine that? I'm the only farm that have frogs.
Right. I was surprised to see, actually, I saw a map. I was at a ag tech event the other night. They showed a map of soil quality around the world. And I was expecting Philippines to be the highest because I'm like, we grow so depleted. Much in Asia. And it's actually one of the most depleted
in
the entire
and
Asia. Yeah, I was surprised.
Yeah, and it's also depleted because in the past, and the reason why, well, another side bit, it's also depleted because we've also depleted our biomass.
Right? What do you mean by biomass?
Biomass meaning like your soil will be healthier if you have other vegetation growing near it. If you have trees, if you have fruit trees, hardwood. Because guess what? They create an ecosystem that supports microorganisms that make your food better, that make the plant better, right? Like you need worms to literally break down the nitrogen, right? Nitrogen in its chemical form cannot be easily absorbed by the plant, right? You actually, like, and the problem with chemical farming is the first thing that they kill is the microorganisms that you need, right? So the soil only becomes like a medium, but it really has no nutrients.
Yeah, you'd have to pump it with whatever
chemicals,
proxy chemical.
Exactly. Yeah. So if there's nothing in the soil, now you're buying more chemicals, right, to feed the plant. Do you see this
linear thing?
Like, now your expenses just keeps going up. And we haven't even talked about, like, the, you know, at least in the Philippines, and I don't know if this happens in other parts of the world, and I wouldn't be surprised if it does, but just taking rice as an example, the reason why it's hard for a rice farmer, particularly a conventional rice farmer, to make money is because the price, two reasons, it's a market issue, and one is in a lot of the villages in the Philippines, a lot of the farming communities, you have probably one or two traders that sell seeds and buy back harvest. So if you have a monopoly and the trader's telling you, I'll give you these seeds on loan as long as you sell to me your product at a predetermined price right now.
Yeah.
Who controls the market?
The trader.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Since 2006, well, in 2006, the price of unhusked rice, palay.
Yeah.
As soon as you harvest it, you want to sell to the trader. It costs 13 pesos per kilo.
Okay.
Another question for you guys. 2015. So the last harvest was in October. I called up my neighbors and asked them how much was their selling price. What do you guys think?
16 max.
Rita, what do you think?
Oh my God. I don't know. Like, I think the same.
I'm thinking that they wouldn't have increased it a lot.
This 10 years now.
16 or 15.
Oh, 10 years. Like, yeah.
So
like,
despite...
Oh, 10 years?
Yes. 10 years. Like, then probably 20, I'm guessing.
But that's even high. Maybe 18, 19.
What about inflation, guys? Inflation has been more than that.
I know, but there's no way that these traders are going to go above. They're not going to match inflation. I'm thinking like 19 or 18.
It's still 13 pesos.
No way. I was being conservative. I was like, 16?
No, I shit you not. It's still 13 pesos.
So
I just called. Actually, it was 12 pesos. I just called. 12 pesos, 50 cents, like on average.
That doesn't make sense because wouldn't the farmer say like, dude, these prices got to go up because our inputs are getting more expensive. There's no way that
would they ever think of colluding? Like as a farmer organization, I'm thinking like, I can see my neighbor, right?
Guys, the biggest problem is the market. They're all selling to one trader. So who's got the leverage? The trader. Right? Yeah. And that's why I say, how do you start breaking this? You create a market for the product, right?
Right.
So if currently the only two capitalizers or investors in farming in the Philippines is, you know, that trader, right? Or someone who lends money. The other one is Monsanto, right? Because grain, right? Via the grain situation. So if you have a system and a structure where if you're a farmer, and the only thing you know how to do or what to do is farm, and the only systems that are available to you is these markets, then even though you know if you're lucky you make $500 after 3 months of rice or after 3 months of corn, you keep doing it. It's like banging your head in that freaking
wall. Almost like you have no out.
Yes,
yeah.
Because you don't know, you don't, A, if you don't have, you know, education, access to markets, networks to market your product, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard for you to change that system, right? So, however, I do believe in the power of just creating a new market. And I'll give you an example, ARC. As soon as we told, right, the feeding program, it's protein and vegetables. It's a lunch that is served in school. Every day there is class. We told the parents and the farmers, we will buy your proteins and your vegetables provided that it's chemical free.
You become the market.
We become the market. And guess what? Day one, they already make income because we don't start an ARC feeding program unless they're suppliers.
So basically you're telling me they got to convert to organic.
So they start converting to organic. So you know, this is not the mission of ARC, but it's kind of like a byproduct in a subversive way, which is through ARC, we are showing families a path to food security and food sustainability through their backyards, right? We're not messing with our farms because they're not ready yet to convert. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not ready yet because to them, they're just still so focused on harvest, right? But we're solving through ARC. So this Chinese wall between my farming business and ARC, they don't have anything to do together, right? So through ARC, the only thing that my farming business has to do with ARC is that whatever I've learned right now in farming and how we make the programs, you know, structurally sound is through all of the insights I've learned from the farm.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's the only relation. So if you have a market now for protein and vegetables where the cash flows is monthly, because you can plant bechai, and in 30 days, you got bechai to sell.
Yeah.
Right?
Bechai is what?
Bok choy.
Okay.
And by the way, you know, FYI, vegetables and protein are higher margin products than rice, right? As an example, and this is one of the reasons why there's high malnutrition among farmers. Farmers that plant rice or corn, guess what their inventory is? Rice or corn.
Right.
Right? Now, if they happen to be in a community where there's an ARC feeding program, right, they can now actually plant protein and vegetables, right, that have a different cash flow cycle, no longer 3 months, now monthly, or if they're really industrious and if they do plan really well every week, mm-hmm. right? Just to give you a sense, a farmer's main, if you're a rice and corn farmer, your main inventory is just rice or corn, right?
Right.
So let's say, you know, it's harvest time, you got your money, that 13 pesos per kilo, woohoo, right? But now, now you have money to buy your not seeds. You're going to feed your family lunchtime, dinner, right?
Yeah.
Now you want to put something more than salt or sugar on that rice.
Yeah.
Because you just got money from that 13 peso per kilo mm-hmm. deal. You buy mungo, right? Mung bean.
Let's back up. 13 pesos, just like, what does that mean in U.S. dollars? Like,
thank you for 13 asking. Pesos that buy is mean? Not even 20s. What's the...
But let's ask purchasing power. So 13 pesos, whatever it buys there, what is the equivalent of something that someone would get?
Like a Happy Meal.
Hold on.
A Happy Meal
it's
in...
like a Happy Meal, right?
No, a Happy Meal in the Philippines is like 150 pesos.
Correct.
Oh, so then it's even less. So 13 yeah. pesos buys... Guys, what does 13 pesos buy
13 pesos buys two chiclets.
Two pieces of gum.
Yes. If you're lucky. And that's what I'm about to tell you. They buy mung bean, right?
Yeah.
Mungo, because it's so nutritious, right?
Yeah.
It's a green protein. It's super nutritious. 1 kilo of mungo is over 50 pesos. So right there, you've already lost on the arbitrage play. Because you took in money as a cash flow at 13 pesos, and now you're buying 50 pesos for the same, you know, like for a nutritious
right.
grain of something else.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're in already is the beginning, right? Is the second layer of why now you have kids not just hungry, but malnourished.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And just to give you a sense, 13 pesos is, today's exchange rate is, I think, 46 for a dollar. So what is that?
Like 30 cents? Yeah, yeah.
30 cents. For 3 months of work, that's how much they get for a kilo of rice.
And how many kilos would they be making?
Well, it depends. So, you know, when we did the math, I think they would, on average, probably harvest, if it's a good year. Oh, God, I don't know what would be. Like, I did the math, but I've already forgotten, so I apologize. Maybe the, let's do the math. So the average harvest per hectare right now is around 80 kabans
okay.
per hectare, right? So that's about 40 kilos per kaban. So 40 times 80,
3,200.
Yeah, 3,200 kilos. So 3,200 kilos times 13,
30 cents.
Times 30 cents is
my
what?
My God, that's like...
That's in gross. That's like not even profit.
That's
we're
not even profit.
Just
so that's like $300.
Revenue.
And that was the end of part 1 of 2. So check back very soon. We're going to upload part 2 that covers a little bit more detail on, Ayesha's exploits in the world of organic farming, and also contains a little bit of her techniques and strategies for how she's managed to balance her life. Farming is definitely one of the hardest jobs out there, so we talk a little bit about how she manages to stay sane. Other things include resources that she recommends in terms of reading and just general life advice. If you want to learn more about what we do at Hidden Apron and who we are, check us out at hiddenapron.com. Also on Instagram at hidden_apron. And of course, if you have anything to say, rant, comment, queries, quandaries, concerns, hit us up, hiddenapron@gmail.com. See you guys next time.